Lecture 9, The House Divided Speech, 1858.
Hello again. In the last lecture, we talked about the Springfield speech that Lincoln delivered in June of 1857. And I mentioned at the end of the lecture that in that speech, we found almost all of the arguments that would be developed in the senatorial campaign the following year. In fact, if you think about the lectures so far, we've covered 20 years of Lincoln's public life. Now we're going to slow down the pace a bit and spend several lectures on the critical year 1858. That was the year that was most important to Lincoln politically, and it was also the most important year rhetorically, because during the Senate campaign in 1858, Lincoln would develop the ideas, the arguments, and the appeals that would sustain him until he was well into his presidency. I want to begin by focusing on the first major speech that Lincoln gave. He spoke in June of 1858 at the Republican State Convention, again in Springfield. This is one of his most famous speeches, the House Divided Speech, and it's one of the most often misunderstood. The fact that it was given at all is somewhat unusual. We must remember that senators at that time were not elected by direct popular vote, but by the state legislature. And so the normal thing to do was to have a campaign for members of the legislature, and only then after the legislature was elected to focus on who the senator might be. But the Republican convention, meeting in Springfield, took the unusual step of nominating Lincoln in advance, declaring him to be the first and only choice for the United States Senate as a successor to Stephen A. Douglas. And they did so in large part to forestall any danger that after Douglas had broken with President Buchanan over the Lecompton Constitution, that Republicans might actually support Douglas, believing him to be helpful to their cause. Lincoln had been asked earlier to speak to the convention before it adjourned, because he had a reputation of being an entertaining speaker, and people thought he would send the delegates home on a pleasant and happy note. In fact, however, the speech that he gave turned out to be an acceptance speech, accepting the nomination for the United States Senate. Now, the thesis of this speech is often misunderstood. We remember it as a prophecy of coming civil war because of Lincoln's use of the biblical quotation, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." In fact, Lincoln intended no such thing in giving the speech. In fact, toward the beginning of the speech, he explicitly says, "I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided." The thesis of this speech, in other words, is not that civil war is likely, but that the country will become all one thing or all the other. Now, what are the one thing and the other? Let's listen carefully to what Lincoln says. He says, "Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south." Let's pause over that for just a moment and take it backwards. One alternative Lincoln sets up is the country will become all slave. The other alternative, however, is not that it will become all free. It's not abolition. It's that the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it. In other words, containing it where it is, so that the public mind, Lincoln's term for public opinion, the public mind shall rest in the belief that it's in the course of ultimate extinction. Now here Lincoln is doing what he did in earlier speeches with the concept of colonization. He's finding a middle ground between slavery and abolition. And he's saying, if we don't become all slave, then the other alternative is the public mind will be convinced that eventually slavery will die out, and so we will arrest the further spread of it. Now, he presents these alternatives in the reverse order. He first says we'll halt the spread. The other alternative is we'll become all slave. And he asks rhetorically, have we no tendency to the latter condition? So he's going to try to prove in this speech that we are tending in the direction of making slavery legal all over the country. He organizes the speech in a very typical problem-solution way. In the very first sentence, he said, if we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. Where we are is in the fifth year of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Whither we are tending is toward national slavery. And the middle portion of the speech, by far the longest part of it, is an attempt to develop the proof that we are tending in the direction of national slavery. Now, before we look at this part of the speech, I want to say a couple things about the way in which Lincoln proceeds. You may remember that in earlier lectures, I had suggested that Lincoln a couple times said that Douglas's professed neutrality was actually zeal for the extension of slavery. He had talked about zeal for the extension of slavery into the territories. Now he's going to talk about zeal for extending slavery all over the country. In the earlier speeches, he doesn't talk about how this will be done. In this speech, he advances his argument by developing the claim that there is actually a conspiracy, a plot, to make slavery legal all over the country. Now, most fair-minded historians would claim that there is no evidence of any such plot. What is interesting about this speech is the way that Lincoln strings together circumstantial evidence to make the plot plausible and to link Douglas to it. He begins this middle section of the speech with a metaphor of a piece of machinery. Of course, a piece of machinery is designed to bring about an object. He says, let anyone who doubts that we're tending toward national slavery carefully contemplate that now almost complete legal combination, piece of machinery, so to speak, that is made up of the Nebraska Doctrine and the Dred Scott decision. And he talks about how this machine is working and tracing the evidence of its design and concert of action among its chief bosses from the beginning. So he develops the image of a machine that is controlled by a group of bosses, and he's going to place Douglas among those bosses. He then goes back and reviews the parts of the machine as they have developed so far. And he refers to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the assent of the people to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which he says is the result of Douglas's perversion of the doctrine of popular sovereignty to make it to say that if any one man choose to enslave another, no third man shall be allowed to object. And this, Lincoln makes very clear, is not true popular sovereignty, but the Douglas version of it, which Lincoln will deride by calling it squatter sovereignty. So the machine consists of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the endorsement of it by this perversion of popular sovereignty, the fact that when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was before Congress, Douglas refused to permit an amendment making clear that territories could outlaw slavery, the fact that Douglas deferred to the Supreme Court before the Dred Scott decision was issued, the fact that James Buchanan in his inaugural address said, whatever the court may decide, I'll cheerfully submit, then the issuance of the decision, and then Douglas endorsing it, and then almost as a diversionary tactic, the dispute between Douglas and Buchanan over the Lecompton Constitution, which Lincoln ridicules as merely a quibble. Now that's what the machine has done so far. Douglas's particular role, aside from initiating the Kansas-Nebraska Act, comes about as a result of what he said when he broke with Buchanan over Lecompton. Let's remind ourselves from a few lectures back that Douglass made clear that the reason he opposed Lecompton was not that it would make Kansas a slave state. In fact, he said, "I don't care whether slavery is voted up or voted down." He said that in order to emphasize that his real reason for opposing Lecompton was that it did not actually represent the will of the people. But Lincoln is going to have a field day with this line of Douglass's. He proceeds, let's be frank about it, to take it out of context. And he says, in the House Divided speech, "I do not understand his declaration that he cares not whether slavery be voted down or voted up to be intended by him other than as an apt definition of the policy he would impress upon the public mind, the principle for which he declares he has suffered much and is ready to suffer to the end." Now, stripped of Lincoln's double negative, what he's saying here is Douglass's don't care principle is what he wants to convince the public to accept. That is, that the public ought not to care whether slavery is voted down or voted up. And Lincoln goes on to say, "Well may he cling to that principle. If he has any parental feeling, well may he cling to it." And he says, that's all that's left of the original Nebraska doctrine. Popular sovereignty is gone. Why? Because under the Dred Scott decision, squatter sovereignty squatted out of existence, tumbled down like temporary scaffolding. It was used only to carry Buchanan into office. Now it served that purpose, and it's gone, and it's been replaced by the principle of don't care. And that's what Douglass means, so says Lincoln, by the sacred right of self-government, that we shouldn't care whether slavery is voted down or voted up. Lincoln then reviews the current state of affairs after the Dred Scott decision in order to suggest that there's actually a plot underway to bring about a second Dred Scott decision. What is the current state of affairs of the machine and its chief bosses? First, a Negro cannot be a citizen. That's from the Dred Scott decision. Second, neither Congress nor the territorial legislature can exclude slavery. That's Lincoln's interpretation of the Dred Scott decision. You may remember I mentioned last time that Douglass believed that the decision applied only to Congress, not to the territorial legislature. But Lincoln points out the territorial legislature is the creation of Congress, and so he says, according to Dred Scott, neither Congress nor a territorial legislature can exclude slavery, meaning that you can take your slave to any U.S. territory. And he argues that if you can take your slave there while the area remains a territory, then when it's time to come in as a state, even though legally you could vote slavery down, once it's already there in the territorial status, you won't do it. And so the third part of the present state of the machinery, also from the Dred Scott decision, is that residence in a free state doesn't make you free, that your status is determined by the slave state to which you might return. That also comes from Dred Scott, but Lincoln says that that part of the Dred Scott decision is there not to be pushed immediately, but to lay the groundwork when the public mind is prepared for it, for another Supreme Court decision, which for convenience I will call Dred Scott II, a hypothetical decision, another decision which would hold that states cannot outlaw slavery. Douglass's role in bringing about this imaginary second Dred Scott decision, according to Lincoln, is to dull public opinion, to make it a subject of public indifference. He says, auxiliary to all this, and working hand in hand with it, is to educate and mold public opinion, at least northern public opinion, to not care whether slavery is voted down or voted up. So what he's saying is, after the Dred Scott decision, we've got this one part of it that says that residence in a free state doesn't make you free. And we've got Douglas claiming, I don't care whether slavery is voted down or voted up, which according to Lincoln is the principle that Douglas is trying to convey to the public. And those will be the means by which the second Dred Scott decision will come about. In this speech, Lincoln, in three different ways, in three different places, makes this argument. And notice how in each case he makes it kind of by indirection. He doesn't assert what he can't prove, and yet listen to what he says. First of all, we cannot absolutely know that all these exact adaptations that he's been speaking about are the result of preconcert. He admits he can't absolutely be sure of a conspiracy, but he goes on to say, but when we see a lot of framed timbers, different portions of which we know have been gotten out at different times and places and by different workmen, Stephen, Franklin, Roger, and James, for instance. Now let me interrupt the quotation for a second to point out the obvious fact. These are not random first names. Stephen is Stephen A. Douglas. Franklin is Franklin Pierce, the former president. Roger is Roger Taney, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and James is James Buchanan. But these four different workmen, and we see these timbers joined together and see they exactly make the frame of a house or a mill, all the tenons and mortises exactly fitting. Or if a single piece be lacking, we see the place in the frame exactly fitted and prepared to yet bring such a piece in. In such a case, we find it impossible not to believe that Stephen and Franklin and Roger and James all understood one another from the beginning and all worked upon a common plan or draft drawn up before the first lick was struck. So his first allegation of conspiracy is the analogy to the building of a frame house. And all the timbers exactly fitting are all the parts of the machine that the chief bosses have put together so far. The one piece that might be missing is this second Dred Scott decision claiming that slavery is legal in all the states. And when everything fits together so well, it's impossible not to believe, even though we can't prove it conclusively, that Stephen and Franklin and Roger and James all understood one another from the beginning. So that's his first reference. His second reference goes back to the wording of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which used the phrase state or territory. And Lincoln points out there's no reason to have put state in this act since it was an act dealing with territories. What's it there for? And he concludes it's there to pave the way for the second Dred Scott decision. And so he says, in what cases the power of the states is so restrained by the Constitution is left an open question, precisely as the same question on the power of the territories was left open in the Nebraska Act. Put that and that together, and we have another nice little niche, which we may ere long see filled with another Supreme Court decision. That's Dred Scott II. Declaring that the Constitution of the United States does not permit a state to exclude slavery from its limits. And then to add to the punch, he goes on to say, this may especially be expected if the doctrine of care not whether slavery be voted down or voted up shall gain upon the public mind. So that's his second reference now. He's talked about the frame house, and he's talked about put that and that together, and we've got a niche for a second Dred Scott decision. And his third reference is the following line. He says, welcome or unwelcome, such a decision is probably coming and will soon be upon us unless the power of the present political dynasty shall be met and overthrown. We shall lie down pleasantly dreaming that the people of Missouri are on the verge of making their state free, and we shall awake to the reality instead that the Supreme Court has made Illinois a slave state. So three different times he suggested the result of this conspiracy will be a second Dred Scott decision. And that really concludes the middle portion of the speech. He's argued that we are tending toward nationwide slavery to be brought about as a result of a second Dred Scott decision for which public opinion would be prepared by Douglass's doctrine that he don't care whether slavery is voted down or voted up. Now, there's little evidence to support this charge of an active conspiracy. But what Lincoln has done in this part of the speech is to string together circumstantial evidence in order to make it plausible. And then for good measure, Lincoln adds that the logic that supports Douglass's position would also justify reopening the African slave trade, which Douglass has come out against. But Lincoln mentions this in order to suggest, perhaps, that Douglass is not sincere in his opposition. He says, "For years, he has labored to prove it a sacred right of white men to take Negro slaves into the new territories. Can he possibly show that it is less a sacred right to buy these slaves where they can be bought cheapest?" And of course, they can be bought cheaper in Africa than in Virginia. Now, Lincoln had said at the beginning of the speech, if we knew where we are and whither we are tending, we should know what to do and how to do it. Having shown whither we are tending, it becomes clear what we must do. We must arrest this conspiracy by overthrowing the existing political dynasty. How to do it? At this point, Lincoln directly addresses a suggestion that has been made by several Republicans, particularly in the East, that because Douglass broke with Buchanan over Lecompton, Douglass is actually in sympathy with the Republicans, and the best thing the Republicans could do is to support Douglass. This, of course, would be the death knell of Lincoln's political hopes, and so in focusing on how to do it, he deals with this suggestion that Douglass should be supported. He says, "There are those who whisper us softly that Senator Douglass is the aptest instrument there is with which to effect that object." And on the surface, Lincoln is very reverential, very respectful almost of Douglass. He says, "They remind us that he is a great man and that the largest of us are very small ones. Let this be granted." But Lincoln wastes no time in eliminating the possibility that support for Douglass is how to do it. He says, "They do not tell us, nor has he told us, that he wishes any such object to be effected." So there's no proof that Douglass wants to arrest the spread of the present political dynasty. In fact, after having said that Douglass is a great man, Lincoln quotes, "A living dog is better than a dead lion," and says, well, Douglass is a lion. If not a dead lion, he is at least a caged and toothless one. What makes him caged and toothless? How can he oppose the advances of slavery? He don't care anything about it. And because Douglass don't care, Douglass can't be the instrument to stop the spread of slavery. Who then should be the instrument? Well, simply enough, those who have based their political platform on opposing the spread of slavery, namely the Republicans. Referring once more and finally to Douglass, clearly he is not now with us. He does not pretend to be. He does not promise to ever be. Our cause, then, must be entrusted to and conducted by its own undoubted friends, namely the Republicans. And at the end of the speech, he proclaims that if the Republicans will only hold together, surely they will prevail. He notes that only 2 years ago, the party formed of discordant elements had come together and come very close to electing Fremont President of the United States. Surely, if they could accomplish that, then if they hold together now, they will prevail. The result is not doubtful. We shall not fail. If we stand firm, we shall not fail. Wise counsels may accelerate or mistakes delay it, but sooner or later, the victory is sure to come. And with that line, Lincoln ends the speech. So we can see that so far from being a prediction of civil war, this is a political speech in which Lincoln maintains that the country is tending in the direction of nationwide slavery, that it's doing so as a result of a conspiracy in which Douglas is playing a part by telling people that they ought not to care whether slavery is voted down or voted up, and that in order to arrest the spread of that conspiracy, one must elect Republicans, namely, of course, himself for the Senate. This speech, Lincoln believed, was a very good one. He was very proud of it. He went down to the newspaper office and proofread the manuscript that was going to appear in the paper, even though he had given the speech against the advice of most of his friends. But this speech would become very controversial in the Senate campaign that followed. In fact, it's not too strong a statement to say that it would become an albatross for Lincoln because of what Douglas would do with it. Douglas did not believe that the country must be all slave or all free. Douglas thought that it could remain permanently half slave and half free. But Lincoln had declared himself it must become all one thing or all the other. And so Douglas, ignoring the middle ground that Lincoln had tried to carve out, this ground about the public mind resting confident in the belief that it's in the course of ultimate extinction, Douglas would claim that Lincoln, having said it must be all one thing or all the other, was declaring himself to be an abolitionist. Now, from our perspective, we might see that as no great problem. But abolitionism was a politically unrespectable position in mainstream politics in Illinois in 1858. If Douglas could make the charge of abolitionism stick, and if he could prove it from Lincoln's own words, this would be the equivalent of Lincoln's committing political suicide. So in fact, Lincoln would spend much of the ensuing senatorial campaign trying to backpedal from the seemingly radical implications of the House divided speech. And Douglas would continue bringing the speech up over and over and over again to try to suggest that Lincoln had admitted that he was in fact an abolitionist. The speech is notable not for the reasons that it's customarily remembered, but it's notable for the advance that Lincoln made in his anti-slavery argument. He took the notion of a conspiracy to spread slavery everywhere, and he mainstreamed the notion. That is, he brought it into the realm of mainstream public argument by arranging his circumstantial evidence in the way that he did, and by connecting Douglas with the plot. This matured the position that he had been taking in earlier years, that Douglas covertly desired the spread of slavery. That's why we ought to remember the House divided speech, not because of the notion that it predicted the Civil War. Now, as I've suggested in these last couple of minutes, there is an important interaction between Lincoln and Douglas. We will see what Douglas does to the House divided speech and how Lincoln tries to respond to that next time when we talk about Lincoln's speech in Chicago in July of 1858.